All right. You've got it on KHUM, and our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. Our 20th campaign, as incredible as that may seem. We've got Professor Maxwell Schnur here in the studio with me. How you doing, Maxwell? Good to see you.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, we were just talking about how time would just goes roaring by, and I was just like thinking, this is our 20th Stop the Violence campaign. It's just like, what?
Yeah.
How is that possible?
Yeah, we've been teaching the Acts 10 Sexualized Violence class for 10 years. You have that sudden realization when you reach those big round numbers of what it looks like or seems like to put in work for a long time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we have been talking for the past couple weeks about privilege and prejudice and the violence of otherism. And I guess we should probably touch on something that it made the news over the weekend locally. Obviously, there was big news that happened worldwide that was unbelievable violence.
Mm-hmm.
But let's keep it close to home. And that was Dr. Rosbacher, the president of Humboldt State University, put out a statement. It was picked up in the Lost Coast Outpost about these two black women, Humboldt State University students, who were in Arcata and being harassed, attacked, if you will, by these two white men in a truck. A bottle was thrown at them. They were chased. Luckily, got away.
Yeah.
Scary stuff.
Yeah.
And this is in liberal Humboldt County.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have this, you know, fantastic reputation for liberal, as you say, and I think underneath that, you'll oftentimes run into pretty fierce elements of discrimination. And, you know, I think that incident is toxic, reprehensible, worth challenging and critiquing, holding those perpetrators accountable and supporting the students who experienced that. I also think it's worth kind of noting that it's such a kind of old school example of racism and discrimination that it kind of calls upon everybody to kind of imagine that as what it looks like. And I think quite a few students and folks in the community experience racism in much more subtle and kind of covert or discreet ways in some ways.
Yeah, we were touching on that a bit in the last few weeks, how it has those overt acts of racism that, as we saw over the weekend, are more and more rare and considered reprehensible. But there are other forms of racism that are almost still accepted.
Yeah. I mean, I think the interesting part is that I would imagine them as related to each other in a lot of ways, that the sort of training for outward communicated moments of violence or hatred in some ways come from the sort of language and communication, the casual sense that you could discriminate or do violence to folks in sort of casual, friendly language. And so I think you kind of build on it. You get more and more comfortable with the ideas of exclusion and hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. And the term microaggressions has come up a few times in our conversations over the past couple of weeks. Explain what that is.
Sure. Microaggressions are small, oftentimes unintended comments, sometimes complimentary, but usually denigrating about a person's sex, sexuality, ethnicity, culture, background. And it's the sort of collection, the constellation of ways that we reduce other human beings' value. And, and I'll give a shout out to Daryl Sue, who has kind of literally written the book on microaggressions. That's sort of where a lot of these ideas come from, is that sense that it might be valuable to think proactively about challenging not just microaggressions when we hear them, but in our own lives, maybe reflecting on our language choices, where we come from. I mean, in your life, Cliff, I mean, we've lived for a while, and the generation that came before us handed us language, and we've consciously chosen to reject a number of the sorts of ways that the previous generation spoke.
Sure.
And that I think, is nothing more than the continuation of this, is that if you have some awareness that what you say or do could harm someone, are you willing to reflect and think in order to challenge that, to stop that behavior?
Interesting. And things do change, in your own lifetime too. I mean, it's like, having now been around for 58 years, I've seen a lot of things change. Things that were acceptable at one point when I was younger are completely unacceptable at this point. I mean, when I was 10 years old, the Supreme Court ruled that people of different races could legally marry.
Loving versus Virginia.
I was 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of crazy.
Yeah, within our lifetime. And I think that's, you know, that's some of what we're talking about, 20 years of Stop the Violence on the Radio, which is that, I mean, the downside to that is that, you know, you start to feel like you're like, wow, am I making a difference? The upside is seeing actual change, language change, attitude change. And I, you know, I'm in it to win. And I think that's the real interesting thought, which is like, what do we do to truly make the world more compassionate, equal, egalitarian? And that seems like the big, you know, like worth hustling at still.
Last week, I was talking with Dr. Lauren Cannon, and he was talking about, you know, the trans community. But one thing we mentioned, and this is kind of an interesting thing, again, watching not only within our lifetime, but within actually just a few years, is the public opinion dealing with marriage equality.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very small amount of time where you look at even California, which passed Prop 8, and, you know, reversing that and actually getting reversed for the entire country in a pretty short amount of time, and public opinion really shifting, which kind of gives me a little bit of hope that there is that we actually can evolve.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my field, my home field is communication. I study how ideas change over time. And that's, you know, my definition of communication is that you would make arguments that pushed out old ways of understanding or believing in the world, and that there's a real active role in creating new language and change. And I think the marriage equality fights, I think trans inclusion and thinking about, you know, structural elements about racism, prejudice against gay and lesbian folks, anti-trans sorts of things, that really what we should be talking and thinking about is how do we deal with the real structural elements, and then also doing that political education and cultural work. And I think if you can do all three at the same time, you get the chance to make actual structural change, which I think is the goal.
It is exciting. And it is amazing, you know, in my lifetime to see what has shifted from acceptable to unacceptable. I mean, you know, we talk about, you know, the not only marriage equality, but just the acceptance and tolerance of homosexuals.
Yeah.
I mean, that was when I was younger, it was a complete otherism. There was just, they were freaks.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's 1964 that the first openly gay man goes on television as a homosexual. And so we're talking about relatively recently to even allow the possibility of existence. And I think there's something similar in trans politics, which is assertion of identity. And then to a certain degree, does the community get itself together in order to welcome folks? I say in classes pretty regularly, you know, there's nothing wrong with anybody. We may not necessarily have the language to welcome and include, and that is, you know, is kind of the stakes. Like, why would you be going to school in 2015? One reason is that you might want to learn and think about how to make the world a better place. And, you know, again, Humboldt, you know, even with our flaws and foibles, I think that idea stays kind of firm in our consciousness, hopefully.
And, you know, the thing that does help drive change is time, because belief systems are one of those things that are really, really, really hard to change in people. I mean, it does happen, but it's very hard to change. And oftentimes, core beliefs, those can be altered with the generational change. And that's why some of this stuff takes so long.
I also think we might put sort of pioneers in the mix, right? Folks who say, like, I'm just going to live, I'm going to exist, and I'm going to not necessarily divide myself up. And we might think about some of the even sports pioneers or musical pioneers who crossed lines and boundaries in order to make different ways of being and different identities sort of conceivable. And I think about, you know, Filipino culture and DJing, right? The idea of having a role model that you could point to as, you know, DJ Qbert is who I'm thinking of, right, as an Asian American to say, look, there's a place for me in hip hop. Ranging from that to even thinking about sort of coming out of the closet, talking mm-hmm. to family or friends, the sense that your identity might not cut against you, but it might be some of the value of difference that makes you awesome. And that part, I think, is pretty real. So risk-taking, we got to put in the mix of how
Absolutely.
Change happens. And also supporter community, what we've been calling allies. And my definition of a real ally is someone who shares risk. I think there's quite a bit of the, like, attempt to make the claim of an ally, but not necessarily, like, in some ways to differentiate themselves. You'll see bumper stickers that say, you know, straight but not narrow, you know, which is like, okay, I'm in favor of gay rights, but don't get it twisted. When it's time to gay bash people and beat them up violently, I'm super straight. Don't worry about that, right? You know, and so I think if we're talking about allyship, the number one thing I think you would name is probably, are you willing to share risk? Are you willing to actually take of your privilege and benefit and say, I'm going to take this privilege out for a spin. I'm going to try to maybe even deal with some of the backlash that folks receive and, you know, own that risk. And that's a little harder, I think, than just saying like, oh, I'm an ally to that cause.
That's a really valuable point that you made, because, I mean, that is where change happens as well. And, you know, and we talk about the generational change, but that can't happen without people putting themselves at risk. Without it being noticed.
Yeah.
Without it sticking out from the norm.
And in moments where people are being pioneers, taking risks in their own lives, I think it's necessary that if you care or in a community with someone that you stand up. And I think that's, you know, one of the moments, like you and I have talked historically about sort of men and sexism. And I think that's one of those kind of meta examples we might think about, which is, you know, it's always unpleasant to encounter prejudice. And I would rather just kind of keep going to the bank line and not deal with the joke that's happening behind me. But I got to imagine that people, you know, who experienced the brunt of that joke would also like to just go to the bank, like, you know. And so, you know, sometimes you're called upon to be political in situations. And I think it's, you know, everybody can and should be prepared to bust up stereotypes and prejudices when they run into it. And a lot of times it happens at like Thanksgiving dinner, you know, and stuff like that. And so you Right. even have standing. They're friends of yours or people who've said something. And I just suggest that rather than the eye roll or once you get in the car talking about how racist you think that uncle is, that you do that work right there with them. Tell them, own it. And that seems to me like a much more, I don't know, sincere engagement to injustice rather than waiting until you're private and then complaining about them.
And more uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that's more risk also.
If we're talking about justice, we're probably going to have to face some discomfort. And I don't think I think justice has to stay in the vocabulary.
Absolutely. And, you know, the reality is that when you are of privilege, and of privilege meaning you are in a position, so you're male or you're white
yeah.
or male and white
yeah.
and maybe rich on top of that. And, you know, just layer on the different, you know, privileges, you know, yeah. the more that someone is privileged becomes an ally, the better.
Yeah. You know, I think one good definition of privilege is unasked for, unearned benefits,
mm-hmm.
right? You didn't ask necessarily to get the skin color, but you might get job access or privilege in ways that other people don't.
Sure.
And so I think you're right that, you know, one question is sort of, do I take my privilege out for a spin? Do I see what I can do with that access, you know? And awareness is obviously the first step, but after that, and I think we almost always stop short of like, what do I do with this? You know, own your privilege doesn't actually help very much.
Right.
It's a right. stepping point on the way.
What are you doing with that privilege?
Yeah, yeah. If we're talking about violence, right, the idea that language and, you know, sort of descriptions would be used to reduce the humanity of someone, let's say to make violence easier. And so objectification of women or objectification or stereotyping of gay people, both of those examples are pretty like visible, knowable ones that most people listening and, you know, could understand. It's probably worth thinking, you know, dramatically about how to challenge that language. And, you know, one of the most obvious things that I'll do in moments with people I don't know is I'll just re-interject elements of humanity based on questions. You know, I'm at the bar and somebody says, you know, look at the woman down at the end of the bar. Boy, look at this, you know, insert, you know, dumb comment here, et cetera. And I'll say, oh, I wonder what their SATs were like. I really wonder if they like soup. You know, I bet when they're, you know, when they're sick, like snot comes out of their nose and they still seem kind of cool and funny. Like, I bet, you know, the complex nature of humans that is three-dimensional, that calls on us to treat other people with respect and care. In moments of objectification, it's an invitation for a community to say, well, we're going to imagine black people as two-dimensional. And it becomes radical, I think, to make that moment more difficult for people, to get, jam up the works or to muck up the gears as that sort of thing is happening. And generally, you can just do it with a few thoughtful, like, counterexamples. So, I mean, I really think that, you know, it's linguistic. It's something anybody can do. And I think it's, you know, a lot of the prejudice has roots in, like, family and small community groups. And it's worth challenging that in the places where you exist.
So let's talk about being an ally. Because there are, I think most people avoid conflict. Most people are very uncomfortable with it. Most people do anything they can to avoid, you know, anything that is at the least bit uncomfortable. What advice would you give to, I guess, people who are very uncomfortable with conflict but do want to be an ally?
Sure.
How do you start?
Well, one thing you might start is listening, right? Right. I think one of the most kind of easy ways that allies go real poorly is they try to speak for other people. Here's what the Native American community really is asking for. And you may or may not be accurate to that community. And so I would avoid any big totalizing claims about this is what it's really about sort of thing if it's not your issue, if you're not involved directly. And so listening doesn't require too much assertiveness skill. You can, I think, become a very radical and thoughtful ally simply by just being present, listening. And in some activist circles, we'll say something like stand up, step back, which is the sense that if you have privilege and you traditionally are the kind of white man that gets access to speak in public all the time, invited to radio or the chance to be a college professor or something,
right.
that you simultaneously say, okay, well, I get access to this. I'm going to bring someone with me, or I'm going to encourage somebody else's voice so that I'm not the only kind of, you know, person who gets these kinds of opportunities. And so, again, that doesn't require much sort of, you know, sort of ability to kind of bust up prejudice on your own, like some kind of, you know, boxing superhero or something. And then I think third, if you're really looking to be a better ally, I think it means sharing space, which means not necessarily, you know, making that all about you. And so in those moments, I think you can inform yourself and get yourself together way before you ever need to sort of clash with anyone. And the final tip is that you may be hungry or sick or exhausted and not necessarily be able to make that moment of injustice clear to the other person. Time is infinitely fungible. You can come back and have a conversation another day. Like, you know, take your time. If you're having difficulty with a coworker, if you're struggling with a teacher who seems to be discriminatory, you know, let some of that sit, process it, try to figure out how to approach that person in a way that you think they could hear. I mean, again, the goal is more to see, can that other person kind of hear and change, rather than can you seem smarter than them or self-righteous or something like that. Tend to think that the call out when somebody comes to, like, tell you, hey, you're screwing up, you've been making anti-gay slurs or whatever, is it a real generous moment. And so this is for all the people who have been called out there, who've been reminded that they should probably think about their language or their bumper sticker or that t-shirt is offensive or whatever. Remember that whoever just told you that views you in enough light that they think you could hear that and change, which is a pretty sincere compliment. If you can hear that. So
the other side of that is that and doing so is also making the other person who is doing something racist, maybe having a racist t-shirt or has said something that was very offensive, those people don't necessarily want to be uncomfortable either.
No.
And that does affect change, because no one wants to be doing things that they get called out on all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the fact that, I mean, if you take a look at something, you know, like cigarette smoking has dropped dramatically. There's still, I think it's at this in California, it's about 14% of the population. It's very, very small.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of this is because there's, you know, people are being called out on it. And it's like, no one wants to be in that position where they're a pariah. And, you know, yeah. there are people who continue to do it because it's their thing. And that's fine. But, I mean, it's, you know, that calling out of this isn't okay when it comes to, you know, otherizing people or making generalizations about an entire group of people, or that no one wants to be in that position.
No. I will note that sometimes people get defensive.
Sure, of course.
And so one of the downsides to calling someone out
is
the possibility that they might tighten
reinforce.
Up. Or even sort of enthusiastically sort of do it. And, you know, I think about maybe a month or a month and a half ago, there was some discussion of the number of Confederate flags in Humboldt
right.
County after the murders in Charleston, and the sense that other parts of the community were actively looking at public institutions that raised the Confederate flag. And, you know, I think I could imagine a sort of tightening up from someone who carried one of those on a, you know, on a pickup truck or on a just, you know, wall or something like that. I could imagine them sort of feeling that judgment and that criticism and almost wanting to kind of like brag about it, you know, that there's a moment of oppositional politics where people get into what they're into. Cigarette smoking is a good example of this, where you tell someone and they say, oh, you know, and they have a litany of good justifications. And so, like, I had a friend of mine tell me that when you tell me that smoking is bad for me, it makes me want to have a cigarette. You're actually making it, you know, worse for the cause you care about.
And I think that's going to be, that's just part of, you know, humans. We're going to have a certain amount that will do that. But I think in the long run, it does make a difference. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I think, you know, the percentage of people flying a Confederate flag at this point has dropped.
And I'm betting they've heard something from someone.
They probably, yeah, it's an uncomfortable thing. I mean,
yeah.
It's, you know, no one wants to be constantly called out. And at some point, you know, ideas change. Yes, there are going to be people who are going to become entrenched and more entrenched in their position than ever before.
Yeah. And I think that just means thinking strategically about them.
Mm-hmm.
How do I reach them or communicate with them in a way that I think they could possibly hear about this? And usually it means out of the public conversation. Can I talk to you in private about this
right.
for a sec?
Yeah.
You know, and again, you may not have the standing to be able to do that. And let's note that possibility, right? If you're undocumented in Humboldt County, it's entirely possible you don't feel comfortable getting into a disagreement with a law enforcement officer. Everybody has different levels of access, and we wouldn't want to pretend that everybody kind of has the universal ability to explain injustice to anybody. And of course, that it's oftentimes hard and complicated. We might note intersectional dimensions, the notion that sort of race and gender might inform the same stereotype about immigrants, right? Where we would describe them both as sort of reproductive bodies and also as a potential sort of anti-American threat. And that takes a little bit more nuance to be able to kind of explain or challenge or critique rather than just saying, like, that's racist.
Yep. Well, the thing is, there's a very large anti-immigrant thing going on right now.
Yeah.
And not only in this country, but worldwide. Yeah. And, you know, with the refugees from Syria, you know, trying to find places to live, there is backlash. And now with what just happened over the weekend with the terrorist attacks, it is an unfortunate time to not only be an immigrant, but especially if you are a Muslim immigrant.
Yeah,
this is this is unfortunate. I mean, you are being grouped by a lot of people are lumping a lot of people into the same category as the terrorists.
The impulse to act after the Paris bombings is such an interesting dynamic. I mean, all of the terrorists, as near as we can tell, at least from the news I saw this morning, are all European national identity, not immigrants from any other place that were, you know, that. And so the idea that we would use the, like that Europe might use and the terrorist bombing in Paris as justification to say we will no longer accept or deal with migrants or refugees is astoundingly unethical as far as I'm concerned.
And with that said, and this is an interesting thing, we have listening to NPR this morning on my way into work that there are several governors of several states in our country that do not want to allow any immigrants from Syria right now. And one of the most amazing comments was that, okay, if we're going to do that, only the Christians.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, really? Did you say that? Did you say that out loud?
Yeah. And, let's just note that many migrants, are leaving incredibly violent.
Of course.
At least in the American context, folks fleeing from civil wars. And, I think it's a very good time to, I'll give a quick shout out to the campaign Drop the I Word, which is an explicit communication attempt to say, look, the way we speak about human beings counts and matters. And when we're talking about migrants and refugees, it's really important because if you remove the humanity of that other being, it makes it so much easier to engage in violence. And most of the acts of anti-immigrant violence that we know about come with, communications that make it much more visible to know where that person's coming from.
And we mentioned this, of course, last week as well, that this is a country made up solely of immigrants. The only people who are not immigrants are the Native Americans, and they are in the minority.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is a country of immigrants. Everyone in this country came from somewhere else.
And we have a long history of immediately forgetting that. The Chinese Exclusion Act.
Of course.
Fierce anti-immigrant sort of paranoia through the 1800s. Moments of deep immigration restriction that happened. And, I think we're a little bit outside of Humboldt County, but not very much in the sense that I think I could imagine a thoughtful listener of KHOM who simultaneously says someone throwing a bottle at two black women on the plaza is deeply racist and troubling to me, and could imagine themselves feeling deeply discriminatory toward an immigrant from Mexico. And I think that in some ways this is a slightly more complex issue to talk about and worth describing as we challenge otherizing. And in some ways they're related, right? The ability to devalue the life of a human being is just a skill that you've learned probably from grandparents, aunts, and uncles, and you can unlearn it.
And there's an interesting thing about layers of racism, where it's like, this is a terrible thing. These two black women who were just attacked with the bottles on the plaza. Why are all the Mexicans coming into this country? Same sentence.
Yeah, we could easily imagine that. And so In some ways, we might imagine that responses like, sort of public relations level responses move us away from the topics we need to have. And I love this kind of program where we could have, to a certain degree, as deep as we possibly could get in 30 minutes, which at least as of today is getting a little deep.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting, this layers thing. It reminded me of a conversation I had when I was young. I was with one of my mom's friends, and they were, quote unquote, liberals. And I don't know, somehow the conversation of racism came up, and they were they thought it was a terrible thing that, blacks were being discriminated against. And I don't know, somehow the thing came up that they mentioned, of course, everyone's got some barrier there. I went, really? Like what? And she goes, well, like you wouldn't marry one, would you? And I was like, why not?
Wow. Yeah.
Why not? Of course. I loved her, why wouldn't I? And she was like, her eyes got very wide, like, wow.
Yeah.
And I was like, that was a very odd moment where there was like the layers of tolerance to a certain point, and then boom, not past this line.
Hierarchy might be the word, right? That I don't mind saying I could include black people if they're entertainers or et cetera, but I wouldn't want them in my fraternity, right? That ability to have the double consciousness of racism, let's describe it, where you simultaneously view yourself as a loving and caring community member and, you'd be willing to go to Ku Klux Klan rallies. And that combo is, a big part of American history. If you there's a website called withoutsanctuary.org, which is the collection historically of lynching commemorative photos.
Wow.
And it is not an easy viewing.
No.
But I will note that there are a number of artifacts from Yreka, Eureka, Santa Rosa in this area on that webpage.
That's scary.
But they mark a kind of joyous community element to lynching, where Boy Scout troops would come. You would bring the sewing circle and take pictures. And so this was initially someone who just collected public postcards that commemorated lynchings.
It gave me chills.
Well, I think it should, and I think that we're not that far advanced from that sort of notion, which is that you would simultaneously love your community and also have the ability to imagine some people as really outside of that community and able to become victim to enormous and serious violence.
Amazing.
Nazi Holocaust could be something similar we could talk about, or Rwanda, which is...
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are plenty of... things we could point out, but we are unfortunately out of time. So I guess just before we wrap up, one last word from you on being an ally.
Sure. Share risks, listen to other people, share space, be as aware as possible of not being at the center of the story, and at the same time that you may very well need to do some explaining to people you care about, and you know, maybe even disrupt some of those relationships. Also, prioritize self-care. The notion that you would be indignant about racism or sexism for 6 or 8 months and then get tired of it is not all that helpful. I'd like to see agents of social change for the rest of their lives, and that means a little bit of sort of when do I do this and how do I do it well. So, yeah, and, you know, care for yourself as well as your community.
All right. Maxwell Schnur, thanks for coming in this morning. I really appreciate that. This conversation, as all conversations on our Stop the Violence campaign, you will find archived at khum.com. Just click on the Stop the Violence logo.